leaders.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world.
Change.
GP made this one right here. You know it's a hit.
Impact.
Liberation is a praxis of action, team reflection upon the world.
Welcome to the pedagogy
Justice.
Of the obsessed.
Welcome to episode 2 of Pedagogy of the Obsessed. Last week, you heard a model of sharing stories centered on exploring a challenge in the world of education through the perspectives of many different people. This week, we have something a little different. At Pedagogy of the Obsessed, we believe that there needs to be a new conversation on equity and how it impacts those working in schools. These episodes will be a little shorter, and we will go in depth into the life narratives of people committed to socially just schools. Our hope is that hearing the stories of these individuals, with both their struggles with and efforts at addressing the smog of racism, as Beverly Daniel Tatum calls it, that you also will find courage to act. We believe in the power of stories and owning your story to change lives. These episodes will always be titled with the acronym REAL before the name of the interviewee. REAL stands for Race, Equity, and Leadership. Without the conversation, there can be no change, and our kids need change. Launching this idea is our own Shanna Peoples in conversation with Dr. John B. King Jr., the 10th Secretary of Education under President Obama and the current CEO of the Education Trust. Take it away, Shanna.
Love for you to start out with your teacher story about your favorite teacher and what he meant to you.
I think about Mr. Osterwile a lot during Teacher Appreciation Week, because if not for having him as my teacher in 4th, 5th, 6th grade, I don't think I'd be alive today. I certainly wouldn't be doing the things I'm doing. I might be in prison or who knows. He made such a huge impact on me. He was my teacher at PS 276 in Canarsie. I entered his class when I was 8, in 4th grade. And right when I started his class, October of 4th grade, my mom passed away. And then I lived with my dad. My dad was quite sick with undiagnosed Alzheimer's. And home was this place that was very scary. My father, some nights he'd be angry, some nights he'd be sad, some nights he'd talk to me, some nights he wouldn't. And he got more and more sick over that next few years. Eventually, I was really doing everything to keep the household going, from cooking, laundry, figuring out how to pay bills. And I couldn't really be a kid outside of school. But I was really blessed to have Mr. Osterwile as my teacher. He looped with us, which was quite unusual in New York City schools at the time. But for 4th, 5th, 6th grade, he made school this place that was safe, engaging, consistent, supportive, interesting. Helen, we read the New York Times every day in his class. We did productions of Midsummer Night's Dream and Alice in Wonderland. We went to the museum and the ballet, and we learned the leader and capital of every country in the world. He really showed us that there was this whole world of possibility beyond Canarsie, Brooklyn, and gave us, me in particular, a sense of hope when it would have been easy to be hopeless about my life outside of school. And, you know, he not only laid the foundation for the sort of academic skills that I needed from school, but really created a socio-emotional set of supports that made it possible for me to be successful in school, to be successful in his classroom. So I'm very, very grateful to him. I'm still in touch with him. One of the coolest experiences I had was getting to go to Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, which he had taken my class to with him and my family, my two daughters, and watch him talk to them about the exhibits just the same way he had to us all those years ago. Just an incredible teacher, and really the reason I became a teacher and a principal and got involved in education policy was to try to do for other kids what Mr. Osterwile did for me.
I love that story for many reasons. One, because there's so much in it. It's so rich about what truly makes a deep learning experience.
Uh-huh.
And I love that it is a legacy story, that it shaped you professionally as far as guiding you towards education as someplace that you wanted to spend your energy and all of your time. And all of those things make it, I think, such a great story. From that story, I wanted to jump off into these questions that are sort of suggested by Glenn Singleton in Courageous Conversation, because one of the things I think that my co-host Adam and I have become increasingly concerned about is the need to have conversations that are brave conversations, brave space type of conversations in our classrooms. And a lot of people, particularly white teachers who are the majority of teachers, feel like they can't bring race into the classroom. But to me, I think current events, and certainly over the past year, are no better context for speaking about it. And he frames these around head, heart, soul, and body. So I'll just start us out with the head one. And something that you have read, article, report, or seen recently that concerns race or equity that resonated with you, and why?
You know, there was this fantastic article in the Hechinger Report. You probably read it. The title is 20 Judgments a Teacher Makes in 1 Minute and 28 Seconds. Mm. It's a piece by Jill Berchet is the author, and it's a piece about Deborah Ball, who teaches about math instruction at University of Michigan. And in the piece, and there's an associated video, you sort of explore how a teacher has to make all of these judgments over the course of a day, over the course of a class period, over the course of a minute and 28 seconds, that send really important messages to students. And the piece really walks through a teacher's interaction with a set of students around a math problem. What Deborah Ball raises in the piece is that her consciousness about issues of implicit bias and her care in trying to not impose bias on her students helps create this really powerful and important classroom conversation. The article and the video show you if she had made negative assumptions about her students based on race at various points, the conversation would have gone in a very different direction. The student who ended up making a really powerful point about math that helped her classmates understand the concept could have actually gotten in trouble, been disciplined, if the teacher had not effectively navigated those many decisions. And so it's just a really powerful piece about the complexity of teacher decision-making and the importance of being really thoughtful about issues of race and power and bias in the classroom. And it's a lovely piece, and the video is really compelling because you really get to see the interaction in the classroom.
That is a great resource, and we'll link to it on the website so people can access that. And you're mentioning your teacher. I'm interested in what your experiences of race as a learner were, or ones that stand out to you as being impactful around how you viewed yourself as a learner or how you felt about school. Or
sure. I'm thinking about this today because we're doing a book club at the Education Trust, and we just read the book The Hate You Give. It's a really powerful book. And I was thinking about some of the experiences with reading that I had, particularly as an adolescent, where I first encountered authors whose experience spoke to my experience. I was thinking about this book, Down These Mean Streets, which written by a Puerto Rican author who kind of told his story growing up in New York City. And I connected with the author and the experiences, Curry Thomas, the author, and the experiences that he was describing in a way that was different from other books, because it was just so much more closely connected to things I had experienced as a kid. And you know, literature just has so much power. It has the power to give you opportunities to see the world from someone else's perspective, but it also has the power to help you understand yourself better. It's just so important that we make sure that when we're constructing a special language arts course, that we include diverse authors and that we give students opportunities to see themselves reflected in the books that they read, as well as opportunities to experience characters and stories that are very different from their own. But if we're not intentional about that, we miss an opportunity. It's just such an important part of my kind of experience as a learner, and something I tried to think a lot about as a teacher. You know, for some of my students was the unit on the Great Migration and the Harlem Renaissance. That was the thing that in our U.S. history course that really connected with them, where they discovered themselves and their voice in the history we were studying. And there's just such a strong need for the education system, really, to be thoughtful about culturally responsive pedagogy and creating curricula that reflect diverse voices.
As an English teacher, I couldn't agree more. And it is one of the most effective ways to build empathy and understanding in a classroom, help people see that sort of takes down this idea of the other in a way that hardly any other type of learning does. So I'm a big fan of books like that. Moving into the soul category and thinking about the idea of belief. So I'm interested to know if you have a story about how your beliefs regarding race have impacted your career as an educator.
My whole career is really focused on issues of equity, particularly for low-income students and students of color. The reality that we still give, as a country, the kids who need the most the least. Low-income students, students of color, have less access to quality pre-K, have less access to effective teachers, less access to a well-rounded education that includes science and social studies and art, less access to advanced coursework like AP classes or international baccalaureate classes or even chemistry and physics and algebra 2, less access to school counselors. So we have these glaring inequities, and that's really been my focus. When I was a teacher, I taught Puerto Rico and then in Boston, and then I was a middle school principal in Boston, and my work while I was in Boston was very much focused on Roxbury, which is the community in Boston where I even had volunteered as an undergrad. There are a lot of challenges in Roxbury. It's a community, it's a historically African-American section of the city of Boston, historically a lot of economic challenges in Roxbury, unfortunately. Violence and substance abuse overrepresented in the community. And so there's a lot of challenges, but kids who need opportunity, and kids very much like me, for whom school could be the difference in their lives. And that's always been a driver for me, trying to create equitable opportunity. And as I moved from being a teacher and a principal and running a network of schools to doing policy work at the state level and at the federal level, equity's always been at the center. And now I'm at the Education Trust, and our mission really is to advocate for education equity for low-income students and students of color in both P through 12 education and higher education.
As you call educators to act, what is one thing that you would advise them to do?
I think we need educators to be activists for a more just society. And so, you know, to ask hard questions. Are African-American students and Latino students represented in the AP classes in your high school? Are low-income students getting the same kind of access to algebra in middle school as affluent? Are the students in your classroom getting the support they need to excel, regardless of race or class or zip code or gender or religion or LGBTQ status, right? I think educators have to see part of our role as a responsibility to address the inequities in our society. And we've got to be vigilant about that in our own classrooms, but we've also got to be vigilant about that in our schools, in our districts, at the system level. And we can't just focus on our day-to-day. We've really got to see ourselves as agents of systemic change. You know, as people think about system leadership, two things. One is, I think it's very easy for people as they are moving through different roles that are more distant from the classroom to focus on policy without focusing on the people who are affected by those policies. And so one of the things I tried to do at the department and still do now at Trust is make sure to spend time in schools, visiting with teachers and students and parents. The department, Arnie Duncan, who's my predecessor, and I both had a tradition of regularly doing idea sessions, idea sharing sessions with teachers, with students, K-12 students and college students, so that we could hear what people are experiencing on the ground, so that when we were grappling with policy questions, we had in mind the voices of the people affected by those policies. And I just think that's so critical for leaders in education, but really across fields, to be vigilant about getting proximate to whatever the issues are that they're working on and really understanding the people, the people's experience who are affected by any given policy or rule or law, grant program. And the other thing I would say is, I think in American society, sometimes conversations about race can be hard, and there's a critical role that leaders play in creating a safe space to have hard conversations. You know, elevating the issues within our own organizations. You know, so I think about the fact that the majority of kids in the nation's public schools are kids of color. Only 18% of our teachers are teachers of color. Only 2% of our teachers are African American men. That reality is not going to change unless leaders, the state level, the district level, the school level, are willing to have hard conversations about what do we need to do differently to recruit more educators of color? What do we need to do differently to retain more educators of color? We have to have those conversations. We have to make sure that teachers of color are heard. One of the things we've done at the Education Trust is done two reports on the perspectives of African-American teachers and the perspective of Latino teachers to try to understand more about why people stay or why they leave the profession and what's hard about the experience of being a teacher of color. You know, we heard some hard things about, for example, African-American male teachers who have the experience of being assumed to be the disciplinarian in their school, or Latino teachers being expected or assumed that they're going to be the translator for all the families who are Spanish-speaking in their school. We have to help people have those hard conversations.
I very much appreciate that as a sort of a call for systems leaders. I love the idea of remembering the people that you serve and having those faces and those voices with you in the room, so to speak, when you're making decisions. And then the idea of recruitment and retention, that's sort of my obsession. I've boiled it down to a very simple statement of, if nobody wants to teach, we can't have school. That's what I'm hoping to find some sort of solution for, or to find ways that we can increase the teacher pipeline. And so I'm particularly interested in strategies, innovations around licensure and things that we do to create climate and culture within a school. Just fascinated with all of those. I really appreciate you noting that.
Yeah, well, I hope we can find some ways, separate from the podcast, I hope we can find some ways to collaborate on that work.
Absolutely. Nothing would thrill me more. Well, John, thank you so much for your voice and your advocacy and for being such a great equity warrior and model for those of us who aspire to systems level work.
Thanks for embodying teacher leadership. I look forward to finding more ways to do some things together.
Absolutely.
We pose the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through the restless and patient continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, and with each other. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they become beings for themselves. Liberation is a praxis of action and reflection on the world.